Hello, everybody. Just a very quick one about Instagram. If you're on it, Meta, the parent company, is reducing the number of political posts visible to users on their feed. This is a real thing, not a hoax. So go to your Instagram profile, tap the three horizontal lines in the top right corner to open the settings tab, scroll down to what you see, click on content preferences, open political content, and turn on don't limit political content. That's an option. Otherwise, you won't see almost anything we post because we are deemed political. Please do that now, or you won't even see the posts about our shows, our fun things. So if you want to see Guilty Feminist content and know when we're coming to a place near you or releasing a new podcast, do it now.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
I'm a feminist, but when Tom set up my laptop to do the Zoom call, I insisted that he put it on a large book so it was more flattering around the chin area. Even though no one's probably going to see the footage. It's just for the other people on the call and for me, so I don't distract myself like Narcissus with my own reflection when I'm meant to be talking about feminism.
I think that's a really good point, Debs, in the sense that there's a cruelty to the fact that any human face-to-face contact... I live alone, bar my four-year-old, and any human face-to-face contact I have now... I also have to look at myself. We are all looking at ourselves
constantly
during conversations more than ever before. And the cruelty that we're doing it during the time where we are taking the least.
It's
we are
so
taking the least
true.
Time concentrating on looking good, but we're yes. staring at it and we're staring at it. And I do wonder yes. whether it's going to affect our behaviour once this is all over. And when we do get to have face-to-face conversations in real life, we're actually going to miss being able to see our own face. And we'll have all learnt loads of like reactions that we're aware we're doing. Like, I wonder if like, we'll be talking face-to-face, but we'll be sort of going...
yeah, angling. I know my angles oh, right. much better now.
Oh, right. We might need to start bringing mirrors out.
It's true, actually, because I can never have a blow dry or anything now. And I'm a feminist, but I miss being prettier than I am. You know, like a blow dry and someone doing your makeup
right.
make you prettier than you are. And I never get to be prettier than I am anymore.
I'm a feminist, but I have created a child so sexist and rude that he started saying things to me as he's drifting off to sleep. One of them, he went, "Mummy, I love you so much." And I said, "I love you too." And he went, "I love you more than a rotten egg." It's the first one. I don't want to rinse them all in one go.
I really love Rudy, and I think he's just got a great sense of humour. I'm a feminist, but I opened House Party, the app. If you don't know House Party, the app, it's sort of like Zoom, except it's got some party games on it. It feels more like you should be having margaritas than a work call. That's the idea of it. And people can just jump in. So if they know one of you and you haven't locked the room, inverted commas, they can just pop up and appear. And that's the idea of house party. And every time you open the app, it gives you some kind of philosophical slogan or trivial fact or something like that. And the other day I opened the app and it said, you can't be angry and grateful at the same time. And I was like, excuse me, but being really angry and then discovering you have a feminist tribe who are as angry as you and being grateful for that, that's the definition of feminism. And I got so worked up, I tweeted about it and everyone told me I was right. And I felt so smug. And then I realized I basically felt good about being cleverer than a social media app.
Yeah, an
throwing
algorithm.
Throwing out fortune.
A fortune cookie.
It's like saying I've outsmarted a fortune cookie.
Yeah.
I was like, what the fuck did you think? In what world did you think you're wise? Because you're wiser than a meme.
I think that's a great one, Debs. Also, when you said I got so worked up, I heard you saying I got so woked up,
oh, no.
Which is kind of what you meant as well. I'm a feminist, but I've got such a sexist kid that when he was drifting off to sleep the other night, his last words before he went to sleep were, "Mummy, you need to cut your nails." And actually, my girlfriend's 400 miles away, so I don't.
No, fair. I'm a feminist, but this weekend I decided that I was going to put on some kind of, even if it was just eyeliner or a bit of moisturiser or a tinted moisturiser or something, I was going to put something on and run a brush in my hair before any call, any FaceTime call at all. Because I FaceTimed a family that I know, that I visited last year, that I FaceTimed many times. They live in Austria and they're from Iraq. And I was chatting to the dad and he put the FaceTime camera onto his little boy, his smaller boy, Bilal. And he said, "Bilal, it's Deborah and Steve," because Steve was in the call as well. And he said hello to Steve. And then he looked at me and he looked up at his dad and he said something in Arabic. And I said to Steve, "What's he saying?" And he said, "He's saying, that's not Deborah. That's not the lady that came to our house. That's a different person." That child thought I was trying to impersonate a more attractive woman. He thought, "Oh, a perfectly attractive woman, you know, who had decent hair and clothes on, not a bathrobe, came to my home. I remember her, played games with her. We played video games together. We FaceTimed loads. That's not Deborah." He denied that I was myself. That's how bad I looked. And I said, "Oh, no, it's just, I'm just in quarantine." I tried to explain. Bilal wasn't having any of it. And I said, "Oh, my God, I've really got to do something." And his father very sweetly just went, "Well, a flower is always a flower." And I said, "Yes, but it is rather withering on the branch, isn't it?" And he just laughed. He just laughed. And I said, "That's it now. I've brushed my hair for every call after that."
Oh, I'm sorry.
It was quite devastating. It's hard not to take that to heart. Not that the child went, "Oh, what's happened to her? She's not made much of an effort." Thought I was a different human being.
On the flip side of that, once for a job for Comic Relief, like a spoof thing about the Kardashians, I had to have contouring done. And Rudy didn't recognise me then either. So I had the opposite. I had an effort had been made. And he found that terrifying. I did. I looked like a Michael Jackson tribute act. It was horrid.
Fair contouring, I'm not sure about. It's meant to be good for photos. I don't
know. Makes you look like you've had surgeries, doesn't it? It's whether you're into that or not.
I am not, but I feel I should run a brush through my hair. Not now. It's all right now. I've done something to it.
Your hair looks so fit, Debs. I'm a feminist, but I feel like I have to say, Debs, fit hair, mate.
Babe, if I had known about this lockdown, I would never have dared to ask my hairdresser to give me a fringe, because look what happens when I have to do it myself. It's just limp.
This is great audio, isn't it?
Right. Have you done them all? Have you got another one?
I've got one more.
Go on.
I'm a feminist, but my kid is so sexist that when we were in the bath the other day, he said, "I just don't want to go near that." And he was pointing at my genitals. And I said, "All right." And he went, "It's just, I don't know what all that hair is on it, but I think that's disgusting." He's 4 years old. And I said, "Tuppence isn't meant to have hair on them, actually. That you'll have hair on your privates when you get older." And he went, "No wonder I hated coming out of that tuppence. It was probably really tickly."
Oh, wow. Well, that that 1-2-3 payoff really did, it did pay off, didn't it? That,
yes.
That rule of three.
Yeah.
Oh, and you're quarantined alone with this person.
Yeah. Do you know the other thing he's absolutely loves to do, which has been one of the most tangy tests of my feminism and my body positivity I have ever had,
yep,
is that every day, at least three times a day, he lifts my clothes up to get to my tummy because he loves it so much and goes, oh, let me go to that tummy. I just love that tummy so much. This is so fat. It's so squidgy. I just love it. And he squeezes it and pinches it and gets his face in it. And what can you do? Because he genuinely loves it. So you have to go, yes, isn't it great? I love it too.
Thank
it's great.
You for my compliment.
Yes.
To quote your show.
And it is a compliment. And most days I can go, yeah, it's bloody great. And today he went, oh God, I hope I have a nice big fat tummy one day. Look at my tummy. Do you think it's fat enough? And I was like, I'm doing something right. I'm doing something
yeah.
right. That's where he's going with this.
From a variety of bedrooms and kitchens across London, The Spontaneity Shop presents The Guilty Feminist with me, Deborah Frances White, guest co-host Jessica Foster-Kew, and very special guests Sarah Cornish Spencer and Zahira Hassan Ali, talking about coming to the rescue. Woo! What a convincing audience sound. This is The Guilty Feminist, the podcast in which we explore our noble goals as 21st century feminists and the hypocrisies and insecurities which undermine them. I'm Deborah Frances White, with me is Jessica Foster-Kew, and we are talking about coming to the rescue. Yes. At the top, I would just like to say that on this Zoom call, because normally we'd be in the theatre, but now that's illegal. Jessica Foster-Kew and I both have jobs that are now illegal. We cannot assemble people in order to perform for them and subject them to our jokes / opinions. Disappointing and financially ruinous. However, what we can do is force people to be on a Zoom call with us and make them clap and cheer. And that's what we've done today. So I would normally, these people would be sitting in the audience watching this bit and then we would introduce them. But we're just going to say who is on the call because they're our guests for later. So should I say what I should say what your titles are at the same time. So on the call.
I can't wait to hear my title, Debs.
So on the call is comedian in residence and chief, Jessica Foster-Kew.
I'll take it. Thank you.
Yep. Honestly, mostly comedians like, oh, don't be silly. Oh, don't be ridiculous. Anytime you give them a compliment, they bat it off. In quarantine, they hoover it up like Henry the Hoover. They're just like, yeah, I've never seen the line.
Thank you. Am I still a comedian?
You message them. Oh, that was a good gag on Twitter. They just go, please and thank you, say it again. It's amazing. Our first guest today, who we'll be hearing from later, is the senior technical advisor at the International Rescue Committee, an organisation which helps people whose lives and livelihoods are shattered by conflict and disaster. It's Sarah Cornish Spencer. And a specialist pharmacist working for the NHS in London, it's Zahira Hassan Ali. Also on the Zoom, but not somewhere in London, as my clipboard says, but somewhere in Leicester, is the incredible Grace Petrie and Folky Ben.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to have you, and they'll be dishing a fabulous and relevant song later. Is the song relevant, Grace?
No.
Okay. An irrelevant song.
Also, I'm excited to see how you dish a song. That's what you said. I really like that.
Get bloody ready. We can dish it out if you take it.
Okay. Could irrelevant and rousing be your new double act name?
Irrelevant and rousing.
Yeah, because I just described it. You said it wasn't relevant. I said irrelevant but rousing.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that would be quite a good.
Irrelevant and rousing, hopefully.
Yeah. Quite a good folk double act
I'd
name.
I'd rather that than be relevant and fucking downer.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Well, nobody needs any more
Very
of that,
relevant, totally frigid.
That's what they called me in high school.
Oh, and we're away. Yeah. So today we're talking about going to the rescue. Obviously predicated on our guests more than us, Jess Foster-Kew. Not that we don't come to people's rescue. We do, with our witty quips and
I've sent people lots of alcohol and
coffee.
Have you? Yeah.
Is that what you're doing? Is that your contribution to other people's quarantines? You're just sending them truckloads of booze?
Booze, coffee and chocolate, yeah.
That's nice. Well, I look forward to my delivery tomorrow.
And to my mum. And I think just to sort of, I know a lot of people are having a really diabolical time during this crisis, but my mum's so posh that she genuinely put out an SOS because she'd run out of tahini and pine nuts.
Wow.
And wow. So
that's a middle class.
Surely the woman, surely she has enough self-awareness to have only told me that that's a crisis. So I sent her some tahini and pine nuts. I really miss her, despite everything. And it turns out she told so many people that a number of people have beaten me to it. She's already had plenty of tahini and pine nuts now.
Covered in tahini. Do you miss her as much as she misses tahini?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a strange old time, isn't it? The at the moment, I'm in that place where I'm past the shock and the horror and the falling off chairs and the exhaustion and the just bursting into tears at a drop of a hat. And I'm into the bit where I'm going, I can do this and I've created my schedule and there are some parts of this that are good for me and it's good to be able to, you know, silver linings. I can exercise every day at the same time, and I've never been able to do that before. Isn't that good? That's good. Silver linings. So I'm now into the point of that where I can see that I've got one more week of finding those linings silvery, and then I don't know what happens on the other side of that. I'll be honest, and I don't think anybody knows what happens when the human race effectively is locked up for 3 months.
Yeah, it's a funny thing, isn't it? It goes from a sort of predication towards moral indignance towards anybody who's not behaving absolutely perfectly during this time. And then around now is, I think, when people start going, I just remembered how impatient I am. And it's a tricky old tightrope. Well, I mean, obviously, we all know what the right thing to do is, and it's stay in. It's easy. It's not complicated.
Have you seen that Goody Proctor meme? Because in The Crucible, Goody Proctor is accused of being a witch. There's a meme that's like, I saw Goody Proctor in the non-essential aisle in Tesco. It's sort of like how people are currently turning on their neighbours and saying, I saw Goody Proctor leave her house more than once today and she didn't keep a good social distance. But I did the other day after going to Regent's Park, just say, I saw Goody Proctor recklessly give someone coronavirus today on her run in Primrose Hill. Because I thought, that's the other side of it. Is that we are all trapping ourselves indoors. And a mate of mine today sent me a video of her neighbour having a daytime rave. Just like loads of people over and pounding music. And I was like, come on. And she's just relentlessly staying in her house, doing all the right things.
Yeah, that would make me raging. I do get raging at things like that.
So raging, you need to rave and burn it off.
The only times I've seen, because I live in South East London, the only times I've seen physical contact behaviour. I've not seen any parties or anything like that. Where I live in Catford, you know that everybody's self-isolating because outside, if I go into my back garden, which I know I'm very lucky to have, at the weekend, I could hear like 5 different types of reggae, dubstep, loads of different types of music and smell at least 3 different distinct strains of skunk. So I know that everybody's staying in and that's great. But I have witnessed some contact, like physical contact when I've been out. I'm not going out even every day because I've got a garden, so I feel like I don't need to. But when I've taken my kid for a walk or whatever, and you see people like fist bumping, or occasionally I saw someone go up on a bicycle to someone in a car and shake hands. And every time I've been like, like that, and then I've realised they're doing a drug deal. And actually, I think for some people that is essential.
That is the thing, because how do you do a socially distanced drug deal? And I think the government should say, drugs are temporarily legal, and this is how you deal them. You leave this on the doorstep. You can, you know, you can throw the money into the backseat of the car. Like, I think they just need to be realistic about this. If people are going to do drugs at any point, it's going to be during the quarantine.
Yeah.
So why don't we?
And
just
I'm going to say that thing. It sounds like it's not about you, but you know when you're like, I've got this friend who, but I have genuinely got a friend who whose drug dealer throws it in a window. Like they like anti-back the bag and then chuck the weed through the window. And I think that's.
But
and
how she, they get the money?
She backs. And she was like,
backs.
We were talking about, you know, people who still aren't social distancing and stuff. And she was like, my drug dealer's got no GCSEs and he knows to stay in and lob my weed through the bedroom window covered in Dettol.
That's amazing. And just to be clear, I also know some very posh drug dealers. So we're not saying all drug dealers don't have any GCSEs, just this one.
I'm talking about a specific one.
A specific drug dealer. I don't want anyone writing in and going, don't stereotype drug dealers. I'm a drug dealer and I've got loads of GCSEs and
on
an A-level.
Any other podcast, Deborah, the host would chip in at this point and say, I'm not condoning drug taking, whatever. No, but you chip in and say, not all drug dealers. Hashtag not all drug dealers. That's where you went with that, Deborah.
Marginalisation and anyone prejudging the education of any drug dealer.
I don't think we even say drug dealers anymore, Deborah. I think we say cheerfulness workers.
I'm telling you. What was I going to say? Oh, okay.
Is this coming to the rescue episode?
Yes. Yes.
A different type of
rescue. If you have any really mild MDMA that won't lower my immune system, please drop it off in Camden. It's true, though, I heard that MDMA lowers your immune system, so we can't take it at the moment. And it's just the very time when it would be great to...
I couldn't disagree more. I genuinely think the sales of MDMA must have gone through the floor, because who at the moment would want to cuddle even more?
Well, I just think you could cuddle your cat or something like that. So you just want to feel happy and
They're
flirty.
Not going to give you a head rub, are they?
I mean, we've been cuddling each other a lot over here in Leicester. We've introduced hourly cuddles.
Yeah.
Have you? Pokey Ben are already cuddling, so throw some MDMA into the mix.
Grabbing Ben every time he walks past me. Yeah. Please throw some MDMA in the mix. There, but you know, by the grace of God, throw some MDMA in the mix. Anyway, cut all this.
I think you might need to rename the show and call it Rescue Remedies.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
That's a really good idea, Zahira. Are you allowed as a pharmacist... for the NHS to be on a podcast talking so deeply about illegal narcotics?
No,
she's a pharmacist. Can you get us any very good legal ones that are just almost as good as the illegal ones?
I'm afraid not.
She cannot. She's officially said on this podcast that she can't. So if that's not an honest... pharmacist, I don't know who is.
I think that's we're going to call
if
it.
If you need us to cut all, if you need us to cut all of this out, we will, Zahira. We understand your responsibility to the community during a global pandemic. So our theme is to the rescue, and because we don't have an audience to do stand-up comedy for, no offence, Posse, I thought I'd do an old-fashioned guilty feminist challenge, because then I could sort of, you know, riff on that. So this week, I challenged myself to come to the rescue. Now, not in the really important ways or urgent ways that Zahira and Sarah are coming to the rescue, but I've got a lot of friends with children. I've got some godchildren and some nephews and nieces and that kind of thing, and also just mates with children. And I've really noticed how difficult it seems to be having them in your house all of the time, like relentlessly in your house, never going out to be minded by another human. It can't go to their grands, can't go to school, can't go to a friend's house. I mean, that is one relentless sleepover you're having with a 5-year-old for fucking ever. It's just day after day after day of that same very small human. So I thought Tom and I should, as people who do not have children, should do something to come to the rescue and do something fun for kids. Because it's not just for the parents, it's actually the children as well. I just feel like they're not having a very fun Easter break, or they can't go and see their family. They can't have friends over for the, you know, probably for the summer. They're not going to be able to have friends coming and going. So I thought Tom and I should create a scavenger hunt. Tom didn't know anything about it when I started telling people we were doing it, but he found out when I gave him jobs. So the scavenger hunt for children went like this. We created a list of things that the children had to do. So normal scavenger hunt would be things like find a certain kind of leaf, find a certain kind of pen, or something like that. But we decided to do one that you could do during lockdown. And so we had creative tasks like create a scene from your favourite movie and video it, or draw a picture of the Easter monster, get a photograph of a grown-up dressed as an Easter bunny. And Grace Petrie is looking really...
Easter monster?
Yeah.
Yeah, don't knock that, Grace, because actually I joined in with my kid and that was our best round.
It was sort of like the idea is you have to imagine what the Easter monster would look like.
Cool. No, yeah. I wasn't knocking.
In a four-year-old's head.
I was thinking all my life have I been thinking the Easter bunny was something... I was like, have I been like not in on a bit?
Have you never heard of the Easter Monster?
I thought it was a bunny and everyone else thought it was a monster. Like suddenly I was going to find out that Santa Claus is called Santa Paul or something. Sorry, go on.
Or that it turns out the bunny was like, uh-oh, yet another Me Too disaster.
Easter Bunny.
So are you suggesting that Bunny is cancelled? Oh, God.
One-way ticket to Cancel Town.
Grace Petrie's favourite expression. One-way ticket to Cancel Town, the name of her upcoming
name
tour.
Of my autobiography.
And we told everyone to be on the Zoom call at the same time. And we had, I'm telling you about this, listeners, because you might want to do it with your kids. We gave them 1 hour. They had a ticking clock. And the rules were that we had 12 things they could get, but they should go after the ones that they were most excited about because there were children of different ages and different interests, and they were going to be judged on creativity as much as quantity. And the two most important, well, the most important rule was they were in charge. So if the parents agreed to play and help, they could help. But if the parents tried to take over, the children had the right to say, thank you very much for your suggestions, but I'm in charge. I'm the director. So you
can I tell you what
me.
That led to in my house, Dad?
What did that lead to in your house?
At one point, Rudy stopped for a piss in the garden, just did it in the garden, and then spent the next half hour just in his pants, but with the trousers still on, but just around his ankles. Didn't send you those photos, did I?
No, you did not. You did not. Jess sent in some brilliant videos. None of them were like that. And they shouldn't. Don't put those in the cloud.
This was so brilliant, by the way. It was the funnest thing of our whole Easter weekend. And do you know what? On top of... I'll let you finish and then I will talk about it from my point of view.
The only thing, other thing I wanted to say really was that but we had two safe words for the parents because I knew some of the parents, so I knew...
This was so Debs. This is so guilty feminist that there were safe words in the children's scavenger hunt. It was the most peak guilty feminist thing that I've ever done outside of doing the guilty feminist, that there were safe words for triggering in the middle of a children's scavenger hunt.
No, the safe words were more for the parents because if you put the children in charge, the parents have to have safe words. One was red, and the safe word red meant that the child was doing something dangerous because I thought if the child says, right, I'm going to recreate my favourite movie, which is Superman, I'm going to jump off the roof, I'm in charge, you can't stop me. Obviously, that ruins the whole Easter
Deborah.
Weekend.
That is every day.
But now you've got a safe word. Thank me every day. I expect an everyday thank you for this. And the other safe word was yellow, and that meant you are doing something to your parent or another grown up in the house that they do not consent to. So if one of the tasks is, that's the most popular almost thing, was a photograph of a grown up dressed like the Easter Bunny, and that meant they got to dress the grown up up. I just wanted to introduce the idea of consent, that if they are like, actually, could you just get that off my head now? No, I do not consent to being shoved in a wardrobe. You know, they can say yellow, or if they're doing something to family property.
Deborah, that is every hour. I hoovered half my house today with 4 stone of child on my back, like with his arms around my neck, going, okay, I've had enough, and cut it down from 5. That's really hurting now.
Did you not try
the
safe
word? It was nice to be able to just say yellow for 1 hour of one day.
Yellow, you need a safe word with children. That's all anyone's ever needed. I fixed it. I fixed parenting. Solved.
Okay.
Solved.
Great. Oh, I feel like Grace did when she found out about the Easter Monster.
No, look, small children are awful. I absolutely really awful. They get better, though. They get better. And then they get worse. And then eventually they turn into someone that when your name comes up on their phone,
you're
they
and then
go,
eventually you're dead.
Well, there's that. But no, you have the future to look forward to, in which Rudy's in his 20s, and when it says mum on his phone, he goes, oh, God. You've got that to look forward to.
Great.
He rejects your calls and rolls his eyes.
Yeah.
Good times. But it needs to be off your back, literally. Anyway, so that was the idea, because I also thought I don't want children sort of, you know, spilling all the cornflakes into a bin when no more cornflakes can be got from the supermarket. And it was really, really fun. They all got certificates for, you know, categories that they'd done well in and stuff like that. And tonight we are stuffing Jiffy bags full of prizes so that they get something in the post as well, because we thought It's not much fun when no one comes to play. So at least if you have a bag of prizes coming, that's exciting. So
that's so awesome. And it was so fun to do. It was extremely fun to do. And when you first messaged about it, I was like, I didn't know if my kid is going to be old enough to like get anything out of it, because also I've had a steep learning curve in the sense that I have a 4-year-old and FaceTime is, and that is a strong point. Mm-hmm. To him, it's like, well, your attention's somewhere else. He doesn't understand that that person, I don't think, is really there mm-hmm. talking to him now. With a 4-year-old, basically, you still have to go, right, now we're going to do this thing. He can't listen to an instruction. He's not clever enough to do Joe Wicks. I've just had the shit kicked out of me at 9 a.m. for half an hour for 2 weeks. Like, it's not... I understand that the man is Jesus reborn. And I was like, is this going to be really stressful? We've got to give it a go. But on the caveat that we just drop out if he can't do it or it's stressful. But what a lovely idea. Let's give it a go. And I tell you what, like we both loved it. It was the hour went like that. I think especially when you've got like a 4-year-old, you're not going to be competitive about it. There's old, for older kids, the idea of the clock ticking and the competition is, when you've got a concept of time, is so exciting. Whereas with him, we just probably did about 4 or 5 of the things, but it was so fun. And you did it so nicely that we did like a bit of maths, a bit of art, a bit of... Like, it was a quick piss in the garden, but like, we did it was all very nice tasks, but like, there was something for everyone. But what's even better about it, Debs, is not only did we spend a lovely hour, that I then was like, get in, yes, you can watch the fucking telly, yes, you can.
We've done activities.
I'm going to sit
now.
In the garden on my own. You also win. You win
garden.
The caregiver. Yeah, you win the caregiver like at least an hour, half an hour, at least half an hour to an hour's guilt-free alone time afterwards. And you've given me something that makes me look like a better parent than I am to tell all the other families I know and all the grandparents about, because I could talk for ages about this scavenger hunt that we did. And he's got a little certificate that he bloody loves because
That's
he did the
great.
Funniest joke in the doctor challenge.
Well, the thing is, he did have the funniest joke. He was the only child to win a funniest joke because he was the only child that made a joke.
He didn't know he was making a joke, Debs. I do hope you realise that. He was
did.
Just giving me a terrible diagnosis.
He's got a really good sense of humour. That child knew he was making a joke. So one of the things they had to get was something a doctor or a nurse would use, and extra points if there was clapping for the NHS in the video. And so he had a stethoscope, a kid's stethoscope on, and he put it on Jess's heart and he went, can't hear anything. I'm sorry, you're dead.
Yeah, he went, no, I was like, I'm clapping for the NHS. And he went, there's no heartbeat, you're dead.
That's a joke. I'm sorry, that child was joking. And it's like a baby chortle, Jess. That's what I thought. I thought he's won a comedy award. Jess will be thrilled. It was the only joke.
I will not be thrilled. I wanted to be an accountant. I hope that I'm giving him enough attention that he doesn't choose this for a job. Christ. He can be so useful, Debs.
Maybe he'll be a doctor. Maybe his diagnosis will be my stethoscope's broken, you're dead.
Yeah.
When you say you weren't competitive, you were jubilant, though.
I was jubilant. When he got his sums right, I was jubilant. Because do you know what? So often he is not an intelligent boy.
He's 4. And it was a coin challenge.
Compared to 4-year-olds or Einstein.
It was 6 coins that add up to less than 20p was one of the things. And Jess was videoing him counting, like, and that's 5, and 5 plus 10 is, and he went 15, and she just went, get in!
Yes.
Like that. It was so funny.
Oh, honestly, because the rest of the time he's telling me that he can see coronavirus and that he can touch whatever he wants because he can see it, and he knew there wasn't any corona on that. And then I told you this when we did on the new normal thing, but the same day where he decided he could see coronavirus, he pole danced in front of 2 policemen on horses. He pole danced around a light, street light, pole dance around it chatting, I'm catching corona. That was embarrassing. And when I bollocked him for that, he said, it's an accident. The whole pole dancing and singing was an accident. And then we got home and then we had a bath that night. And he went, Mummy, I've just seen your tuppence. Bad news, it's got corona on it.
He's a god with a sense of humour. He is your son.
So yeah, I'm
he's
really
doing gags.
Happy when he gets a sum right. I need something to be proud of.
Are you sure he can't see coronavirus? Because
well, that's what
have
I
you ever
said,
seen
though.
The Sixth Sense? Because maybe
that's what I suppose.
You know, maybe that's I'm just I saying. Said. Maybe he can.
Has he got the seventh sense?
Well, and he could be a superhero. At the end that he could see coronavirus all along. That's it. Bruce Willis is coronavirus.
He could be the one curing the world with his special.
Yeah. Get him on to bloody Chris Whitty.
Yeah. So our guest today, as I've told you, one is the senior technical advisor at the International Rescue Committee. The other is a specialist pharmacist working for the NHS. Please, please give a huge welcome to Sarah Cornish Spencer and Tahira Hassan Ali. So, first of all, Zahira, the NHS workforce, I am not sure who it really includes. So we know nurses are often given great precedence, and the majority of them are female. But what about other staff? And what's the gender makeup in terms of feminism?
Yeah, I mean, we all know that there's doctors and nurses, and I mean, lots of people didn't even know that I existed. But we forget very important characters like our porters, which take our patients for tests, our dietitians, our healthcare assistants, because without them, the nurses wouldn't be able to do a lot of the jobs that they do. So that there is loads of staff that make up, you know, the hospital. It's just not what, you know, we traditionally know as just doctors, nurses. We've got our cleaners too, our catering staff, which actually come on the ward. And during a pandemic like we do have, it's very hard feeding patients who are unwell. And how do you feed someone? Mm. I mean, how do you sterilize plates and knives and forks? And there's a lot of logistics that go behind the scenes that people forget about. Do you know, it's funny you should ask about the workforce in terms of how many men and women. I was actually reading a report the other day from December 2019, and it's almost 50-50, which is really interesting. And it takes you, you know, to all kinds of gradings of jobs, really high up, you know, down to sort of basic grade professionals. And we are at an age where it's, I mean, women are playing a very big role, just as men are. But we also have to remember that there's certain jobs that there are more men working. For example, your porters, they are predominantly men. You look at your nursing force, they are predominantly women. But not to say that men or women can't do these different jobs.
So what's it like working for the NHS at the moment? I mean, what's the feeling there? When we all come out and applaud on a Thursday, I've seen some NHS staff saying they really, really have been moved by that. And I've actually seen videos of people crying.
I mean, it was moving for me when my family did it. And, you know, you stand outside and you can hear people down the street. You can't see everyone, but you can hear them. And it's heartwarming to know that everyone who's staying indoors is supporting you. Mm. Because, I mean, I go to work every day. And at first, it's scary, you know, going in the underground. And it's literally like being in some kind of zombie film. But the more you think about it, the more you realize that everyone's with you. There's no one there, but they're not there because they're supporting us. I mean, it's great that everyone's clapping and the public are supporting us, but we need a lot more support than just claps. And that's something that, you know, lots of people are raising money for because we do need equipment. We do need PPE.
What's PPE? We've heard a lot about PPE, but can you break that down?
So PPE is the protective gear that we wear. And PPE hasn't just started happening. You know, people wear PPE all the time in their different professions, like builders wear, you know, helmets and they have gloves. So in the same way, we have PPE in the hospital. But when we're looking at coronavirus, we're looking at extensive PPE. So you have to make sure that there's no gaps in it. So, you know, there's no air that you're breathing in when you're treating these patients. It's all going through filters. And it's not just about wearing the stuff because you need to know how to wear it. So we've got this great thing that happens in the hospitals and you have a buddy. So Deborah, if you and I were going into ITU to treat a patient or see a patient, we would go in together. You would watch me put on my mask, my gowns, my gloves. And there's actually a protocol that shows you step by step what you should be putting on. And you would watch me and I would watch you. And we do all the final checks and then go in together.
And what's
it's just
ITU?
A way of safeguarding. Oh, intensive treatment unit. Some people call it ICU, which is intensive care unit, which is the same thing.
So that's where if you're really bad, you go into the intensive care or the intensive treatment.
Yes.
And You have to have really, really, really protective clothing in there because the people are very, very vulnerable. So they have to be protected from you and you have to be protected from them.
Exactly. It works and, both ways.
And you're a pharmacist, but you were in a hospital. So what does that mean practically?
So I know everyone remembers or thinks about their pharmacist as going to Boots, going to Lloyd's. I mean, we have pharmacists that work across the board. So in your industry, in your drug discovery and in the hospital, you would see me on the ward with the doctors on a ward round because we provide clinical support, which is advising on drugs. I'll give you intensive care unit setting because that's quite important in our role. When patients are on ventilators and, you know, they're unable to eat because you're sedated, you're paralyzed so that you can have this breathing tube down you. You have all these lines which are feeding you or, you know, catheters which are removing your bodily excretions. So for a pharmacist, you go in there and you're looking at how am I going to administer their drugs? Not everything is available to be infused, so given intravenously. So can we crush tablets? Can we dissolve the tablets in water? If it's something that needs to be changed, can we do it so that the patient is still being treated and they're not becoming more vulnerable because they can't be treated for pre-existing conditions? But also knowing a patient's history, being able to coordinate when they've come in, is it just COVID? What else are they suffering from? Usually by looking at their drugs, you can pick out what is wrong with them. And that's something that people often forget. And you did mention earlier about dietitians. Yeah. So when you have patients who are unable to eat, you have feeding tubes that go down and you need your dietitians there to assess the patient, look at their weight, measure their salts. And these are small professionals that come into play in very, you know, big ways when patients are critically ill.
I think there was some misconceptions around the idea, early doors at least, or perhaps it's, I don't know, perhaps it goes on, but there's so many people offering advice on nutrition on social media, celebrities, etc., personal trainers who have no, you know, they're not qualified in any way to tell people what they should or shouldn't be eating. So in almost a well-meant backlash of like, why are we clapping dietitians? But like, it's a huge medical job to feed people that can't eat because there's a ventilator down the pipes. That is not the medical way of describing that.
I'm an IBD specialist, so I deal with patients with Crohn's and colitis. Diet is a very huge thing. In our clinics and in our meetings, you know, it's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, dietitians, psychiatrists, because these are core professionals that actually help in every single illness, not only in the illness that I'm specialised in.
Are the people with the illness that you're specialised in particularly vulnerable to COVID? Or is I wish I knew more about who is especially vulnerable to it.
It depends on their level of disease or illness.
Right.
It depends on the kind of treatment that they're having. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of patients have received text messages and letters from their GPs. So if you're listening and you're unsure, call your specialist, find out what category you fit into, because you might have received a text message as a blanket rule that, you know, the government is using, but you need to know specifically what applies to you. So we've got patients who are vulnerable in every illness, but it just depends what the severity is and what treatment you're receiving.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
And Sahira, we've heard a lot about medical professionals can get a viral load. I read a statistic that 20% of the deaths from COVID were medical professionals because they're being overly exposed to it. And that's a deep concern for medical professionals, isn't it? Like, I worry for those on the front line. I read today that a pregnant nurse had died, and that's really devastating. Is there anything we can be doing? You know, we know you need more protective clothing and equipment. Is there anything else that we can do to help with that?
I mean, there's so many groups on Facebook of nurses and staff that work in hospitals where we're sharing stories and struggles. And it really is all just around PPE. I mean, this is on the news. You've got the care homes and the staff that are working in the care homes. There, some of them have moved in because they don't want to put their patients at risk because mm-hmm. they don't have enough PPE. Yeah. But at the same time, they're making a sacrifice, leaving their families and going in there.
Yeah.
You know, they're putting their lives at risk.
It's really, I heard about that pregnant nurse. I was just so devastated. I couldn't shake it all afternoon. I just kept thinking and thinking about her. But she was in the third trimester. So I think they were able to save the baby. And I'm like, why was a nurse in her third trimester working?
Because they did that. I think they did that. I heard they did that about a week and a half ago, that they said to pregnant NHS staff, like nurses especially, and well, also NHS staff, actually, if you can work, please do. If you've not got symptoms, please do.
And our health secretary is saying, oh, well, we don't want people overusing the protective equipment. It's like, yeah, we don't want you overusing PPE. It's like, yeah, if you were there every day, mate, you would have four of everything on. I found that really, really, really upsetting. What's the feelings, Zahira, about things like that?
So I work very closely with a nurse who is an ex-ITU nurse. She's been working at IBD, but because of what's going on, she's been deployed back to ITU. And she said, you know, usually they get three breaks during their shift, which is often over 12 hours. But because they don't have enough PPE, they're limited to two breaks. And
because you need to change it if you have a break.
Exactly. You've got to take it, well, dispose of it. It's you can't wear it again.
Yeah.
You know, it's very difficult for them.
I heard you need breaks because it's really sweaty and hard to breathe in the PPE, and people are getting big cuts and chafes behind their ears where you're wearing the same looped thing around. Like,
saw that nurse.
It's just, it feels like it comes down to an understaffing issue that was there way before this. And I'm not saying that there was, you know, that there's any health system that was necessarily going to be equipped for an emergency like this in its entirety. But it does feel like it's shining a light on an underfunding and an undercaring that was happening with the NHS generally enormously and understaffing.
Absolutely. You know, everyone works extra hours out of goodwill because we care. And I know it sounds ridiculous, but we care.
It's just infuriating. It's not ridiculous.
And when you look at the nurses who are working these long shifts who can't have breaks, I mean, you know, lots of nurses are now not drinking fluids when they're at work because if you need to pee, you've got to take everything off.
Oh, God. Yeah.
And we don't have enough. So what do? You don't hydrate. So you're getting nurses who are,
headaches.
You know, dehydrated, tired, emotionally burdened. I mean, it's a really difficult situation to be in.
I tell you, after this, I hope the nurses come out into the street when the crisis is abated and say, we're not going back in unless we're paid double minimum. I really hope they do, because people would. People would just be like, you have to pay them now. And I know that the government will probably, we were talking about this morning on Robin Inson, Josie Long show, but the government might go, of course we would, but now, of course, we've got no money. But they
I think
always do
I would hope that they would be fucking mobbed if they dared.
I hope. I really do hope. What can we do? Because they're getting us to donate money now. We all are donating money and raising money, but it feels like that should be tax. I mean, it doesn't matter. We'll just do it anyway. But it feels like tax.
It's big society,
people.
Isn't it? That's what Tories do. But it's big society. We pay for it individually through philanthropy. It's bullshit.
Feels like Kickstarter, doesn't it? Like, why don't we all chip into a pot? Yeah, that's tax. us raising money is tax. It's just another way of taxing. Well, just tax people. Otherwise, the people who care and the generous people will give, and the other people who will just keep on hoarding. You know, Richard Branson is not going to be like, oh, yeah, I'll do a direct debit for a tenner, is he?
Gordon Ramsay. You know, you don't have to furlough your staff. So yeah. Gordon Ramsay just sacked his.
Fucking hell.
No.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's what a big society. What a lovely big society we live in.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's not very hopeful.
I wanted to say, based on what everyone's giving, because a lot of communities are, you know, coming out and giving us free food and, well, lots of perks that have come out. We don't need those perks. What we really need is that people need to help the vulnerable in our society, mm-hmm. because there's so many people unable to leave their houses. There's so many people who've lost their jobs, you know, because of this, that now can't actually afford any food. And I mean, the trust I work for are really lovely. They're catering for us. So we get breakfast, lunch and dinner if we want, you know, free of charge. Yeah. And they've taken on that so that they can ensure that their staff are fed, because a lot of people have had to move out into hotels because they don't want to, you know, take anything back home to their families.
So perhaps refocus efforts to looking, if possible, after people who, there are so many ways to do it, aren't there, actually now, through community groups, online, Facebook and stuff like that, but also the Good Map NHS Volunteer Service. There are ways to make yourself useful and to, you know, within the rules of what we must do, keeping away from people, you can feed people. There's somebody I knew starting a campaign that had some government backing, I think, where I can't remember what it's called, and that's really unhelpful, but perhaps it can go in the podcast notes if I can look it up after, Debs. But where if you're interested in cooking, it's all around the country. They'll pair you up with somebody who's completely isolated, who can't go out at all. They choose what they want for dinner. The people running the campaign will send you the ingredients if you're into cooking, and you cook it for you and for them, and you talk to them about what they thought about it and stuff like that. So there's lots of like cool things like that cropping
that's
up.
That's fantastic. And we need to bring Sarah in.
Yeah.
So, Sarah, I know you because your CEO is David Miliband. Can you tell our listeners who you are, what you do?
Sure. Hi, everybody.
Hello.
I'm a massive fan of the show, so ridiculously nervous.
No.
Honestly, it's just think of it as any other Zoom call you've ever done.
Well, I do a lot of those. The IRC works across the world responding to conflict and crisis. I work in the Women's Protection and Empowerment team. So we're working in refugee camps and displacement settings all across the world, helping women recover from violence. So as you can imagine right now with the COVID outbreak, and it's sweeping across a lot of countries with very, very limited healthcare systems. And then you have on the periphery of society, displaced women and girls already living in very fragile kind of situations. And this is another kind of challenge in their lives. So I'm part of this extraordinary team of women across the world, and mainly I work in Africa. So we're trying to keep services open, just like in the UK with, you know, the efforts to kind of keep domestic violence shelters open. We know that in this situation with all of the isolation measures in place, which is really widespread, right? Everybody's getting kind of told to stay at home in Kenya and Ethiopia and across Africa. Mm. And these refugee women and displaced women are already incredibly isolated. And now they're being told to stay at home. We know that the services that we try and provide are not enough, right? Like it's difficult with the money available to have enough safe spaces, to have enough kind of access points for women to come and access the services they need. So COVID is now another barrier, another risk, another barrier that women are facing. And the team that I work with is trying to keep
services
going.
How are they feeling? How are your team feeling in response to, well, COVID and everything on extra that's provided on top of all the stuff that...
It's really overwhelming. I mean, we're all connected, aren't we, in this kind of moment of like personal fear and crisis, as well as what we're trying to do in like our daily work. And it's the same for our teams.
Mm.
I'm really privileged to work with a lot of women who have worked with us for a couple of decades, like since they were displaced themselves. They've now worked with us over the last 20 years in the Violence Against Women and Girls team. and they've trained as social workers, they've worked their way up, and now they're leading the response in other countries. And, you know, some of my, you know, amazing colleagues, Marion Rogers, Esther Conley, they kept services open during the Ebola virus outbreak in West Africa. So they know, you know, how to keep a safe space, like what it means to like have a safe space where women can come and sit, you know, in a socially distanced way and keep services open and keep having opportunities for that social support, because everyone's really overwhelmed.
Yeah.
The women volunteers, we have a lot of refugee women volunteers that are running these services.
Mm.
They're afraid, right? They're coming, they're trying to help, they're trying to keep connected, they're trying to keep offering support to each other. And they're scared. Like it's really like Zahira, you were describing so eloquently. It's tough to keep putting yourself on the front line and to keep moving. And our staff have families, and the volunteers have families, and we're all kind of connected, I guess. And that's not knowing quite what to do right now, right? It's really an overwhelming time.
Yeah.
So, what do you think refugee women are most worried about at the moment, and how can we help?
So, you know, we're trying to get funding. So we're trying to increase the amount of money available. The International Rescue Committee has been campaigning around, you know, some of the really scary facts that are out there about like the handful of respirators that some of the countries hosting, some of the largest refugee populations in the world have in West Africa and Central Africa. It's a time where, yeah, we need more people to kind of dig deep and contribute to the appeal so that we can try and keep health services going. So that we can adapt our programming so that life-saving kind of violence response services are there. There's a lot that needs to be supported right now. I think it's really challenging in a lot of countries and a lot of refugee camps where women were sustaining their families with like day-to-day kind of livelihoods that have now been completely shut down. So we're really looking at like not enough food to eat, going to collect water from a communal water point, using communal toilets, going home, a very stressed family environment, increased child abuse, increased domestic violence against women. It's a pretty tough time.
It's just so extraordinarily extreme. Ultimately, the most effective way to help is to, if you have spare money, give spare money and keep the ship afloat.
Yeah.
But in terms of the humanitarian system, like generally, in the sense that it feels like a lot of the things we're talking about, the same way we're talking about to Zahira earlier, is that what we're seeing now, in the same way that everybody's seeing like elements of their personality amplified, we're seeing the flaws and the glorious things about various systems and various programs and various institutions and various companies amplified. The humanitarian system generally, any sort of flaws or brilliant things being amplified by the current situation.
It's not going to surprise you. It's the same kind of thing that we're seeing around each other here, isn't it? So like there is that increased connection, like people are really reaching out to each other. It's a very patriarchal system, the humanitarian system. There's a lot of kind of macho toughness to it, right? My wife, Danielle, wrote a paper called Cowboys and Conquering Kings that is all about that kind of real Wild West macho.
What that like really big kind of manly saving people.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so I think what's happening now is that because people are feeling really vulnerable and staff are kind of checking in with each other a lot more, we're seeing a lot more of like a feminist way of interacting with each other. It's certainly something that in our team, you know, I was always really proud that we kind of put the personal first. You know, we're checking in with each other, we're seeing how we're doing, we're aware of how everyone's juggling lives, especially the women, right, are overwhelmed with a lot of responsibilities on a day-to-day basis. Now people are asking and are checking in, and you know the kids are running around at home, and you know everyone's got all this extra stuff going on. And so I think that could make a bit of a change.
Mm.
I mean, it would be nice, wouldn't it, if some of this stuff was sustained after the crisis is over. Because it feels like we are bringing our real kind of authentic selves into the workplace a bit more.
The least we can do is try and learn some lessons.
I mean, wouldn't it be nice?
Yeah.
How much, Sarah, does the Women's Protection and Empowerment Team of the International Rescue Committee need the wider women's movement, need feminism?
It's massive. It's like we really see ourselves as a women's movement. We're trying to connect. We're on Zoom a lot too at the moment, connecting across huge distances, trying to kind of come together, pool our knowledge, support each other. And then we connect with the wider women's movements to kind of support refugee women. Like if refugee women are in a country where they're welcome and where they're supported by the wider women's movement, I mean, that's an amazing act of kind of solidarity, because these are countries that don't have an awful lot of money that we're working in, right? And to have the national women's movement kind of embrace refugee women's rights and to see that connection happening at the community level is one of the most amazing parts of what we do.
So can we donate directly to IRC?
Yes, absolutely.
And that's on your website?
Yeah, which is in the show notes.
And we'll put also, a link in the show notes, or you can Google the National Rescue Committee. Now, if you are listening and you think, oh, God, last thing I've got is money at the moment. I've been furloughed. I've just been put off. I don't have any money. I'm worried about my future. We totally understand that. But lots of people have got the same income they had and nowhere to spend it because the pub's shut and their gym membership's been put on hot ice and all of that. So amplifying, giving the IRC a follow, retweeting them, quote tweeting them, post them on Instagram, telling your friends who do have good jobs who are still earning, but, you know, Pizza Express is closed. They're just coming home and watching Netflix and doing origami, as we all are.
Very cheap origami.
Yeah, send out a WhatsApp and say, hey, have you thought of donating your gym membership to the IRC?
Yeah.
That would be an act of great solidarity because it would mean so much to them. Just the fact if you following and seeing them, being seen is a big deal. And it's the same with the NHS. Zahira, what's the best thing we can do for you? Is there a good place to donate to the NHS or something else we can do? You said we should be looking after vulnerable people in their own communities. Jess suggested a brilliant cooking scheme. Is there anything else you would like us to do for you?
I mean, support one another, stay at home.
Stay at
really
home,
stay at home.
But if we can donate to those NHS pots, as much as
absolutely.
We should not be having to do that, on principle, it's the government's responsibility. We will fight that later and we'll donate now. So we can donate because the main thing is you get to wear that protective clothing because we don't want an enormous amount of our staff overloading. So actually, screw the government right now and we will pitch in, and it's just a form of tax. Sarah, is there anything else you would like us to know about what the IRC do or the sort of international scene for refugees at the moment?
I just want to really get the address right.
Fair.
Okay, I'll be like, follow us on Instagram and Twitter at @rescue_UK.
@rescue_UK. Brilliant. At minimum, give them a follow and amplify them. But if you have got any spare cash to divert their way, please, please, please do, because there's somebody else who should be getting an applause. You know, as much as Jess Foster Q and I miss our applause, and we do miss it deeply, I am glad the applause is being diverted to the NHS on a Thursday night. Some people are quite cross about the applause. They say, oh, that, what does that do? And blah, blah, blah. And you should be doing this. And
it feels like that same debate about like, what's the point of weddings and parties and stuff like that. Like regardless of politics, like those things bring groups of people together mm-hmm. at the same point in time. And it puts a tent peg in the maps of all of our lives, which are all going all over the place. And our lives have all suddenly stopped and our pegs are all staying still. And it gives us a feeling of all coming together at the same point, mm-hmm. at the same time, to a shared sense of emotion and care. We're saying, I care about this thing. It's not nothing. And it's trite and it's unhelpful to say it's nothing, but it's not enough, obviously. Mm-hmm. And what most people can do, if nothing else, at the moment, it's a mad time because you can be an activist by just fucking staying in.
Mm.
By
an inactivist.
An inactactivist.
Well,
inactivism.
That's good. Yeah,
it is, though, but also, especially as time goes on, I joked about it at the beginning, but especially as time goes on, the more desperate you get to go and see the people that you love and hold them and touch them, just remember, it's weeks. It's weeks. It might be several weeks, but it's weeks. And you will be able to again, so just wait. Do as you're fucking told. And I say that as someone who fucking hates authority and being told what to do. Just do it. Just do what you're told.
I think we need more mothers and toddlers to get out on the telly to put this message out. Because the way
I'm
you're saying
shit kicked out of me day in, day out.
And yet, I refuse to leave the house. Is there anything, Zahira or Sarah, you came to say that you did not say that you would like to leave on the Zoom?
Don't wear gloves. Gloves are to be worn when you're doing a dirty job. And I say dirty because in hospitals, we class, you know, wards with any disease as a dirty ward without clean, just so that, you know, it's a way of distinguishing.
So if you've got a broken leg, you're in a clean ward.
Yes.
If you've got COVID, you're in
dirty ward. Because if you think about it, a nurse puts on a pair of gloves, she treats the patient, discards the gloves. You wear those gloves, and I see this on the tube every day, and I really sometimes just sit there watching people. You wear a pair of gloves and...
Well, just normal winter gloves.
No, people wearing disposable gloves.
Oh, right.
On their
you're
commutes.
Taking them away, you're diverting disposable gloves. You've got any disposable gloves, can you send them to the NHS?
You wear them and you touch the tube, you touch the poles, the seats, and then you take your phone and you play on the screen with this dirty glove, and then you take the phone and put it straight on your face. You may as well just lick the seats.
You heard
because
that here.
Because you're not doing anything.
Then
you'll go home and touch your doorknob and then inside the house. What are you doing?
I think people have been thinking, if I put the gloves on, but I don't touch my face, I don't touch my mouth, eyes and nose, I'm helping.
You're
but
touching
actually, if you touch your phone,
else.
You're scuppered, right? And that goes. But in terms of, like, if you're going to the shop, then...
Wash your hands.
Yeah.
Because
just,
you know...
Just wash your hands before you leave. Wash your hands when you get home.
Exactly.
Try not to touch your face while you're out. And don't touch your phone while you're out, if you can.
Wear a mask, wrap... In fact, don't even wear a mask. You can literally wrap a scarf around your face.
I did try that, but the smell of my own breath, Sahira, was so offensive by the end of one Sainsbury's shop. And if I'm only having that exciting outing once a fortnight, which I am, I don't want to spend it that close with my own home cooking.
Jess Foster, have you got anything to plug?
Oh, I would love to plug... I obviously don't have any gigs going on at the moment, but the second half of my tour is likely to hopefully be rescheduled into the final months of next year. So keep an eye on my website. But mainly I have a podcast all about eating called Hoovering, which I am keeping up, and I'm getting some fierce and very relevant guests to talk to me who I think are going to say either very funnily distracting or very pertinent and helpful things about eating during quarantine and lockdown and the sort of psychology of eating or just make you laugh because we'll sit down in our own homes and eat something absolutely disgusting that's already gone off from our cupboard together. So it's the usual spectrum of silly to serious on there. But yeah,
it's brilliant and delicious podcast. It's from Jessica Foster-Kew. It's called Hoovering. You must listen to it. I absolutely insist. Also, can I say... Priti Patel, our Home Secretary, announced that you could call if you were frightened of domestic violence, you could call 999 and then you could just press 55 and someone would come. And a load of people on emergency service have been saying on Twitter that absolutely is not accurate. They will just assume it's a misdialed call. They'll assume it's a butt dial.
Oh my God.
So, I know.
That so what fucking person.
What
so,
the hell?
So what you've got to do, this is a UK thing, gang. So if you're listening internationally, this is, you know, check your own emergency services details. But in the UK, call 999 and then you have to wait for the queues. Now, if someone starts speaking to you and it is not safe for you to say, hey, come and help me because you're frightened of the person you're with, you then press 55 and they'll take from that. You can't speak, but please listen and follow the cues as much as possible, because otherwise they might just think it's a pocket dial. The Home Secretary got that wrong. I shared what the Home Secretary said, should have known better, but of course was trying to, you know, help my following. But so did Hugh Laurie, and everyone was like, oh, please reshare this. And then he's had to, you know, say, sorry, I've got it wrong as well. Also, my friend Ellen Jones, who has autism and talks about autism, told me to pass on to you that they've changed the laws. It used to be you could only go for one walk a day, no matter who you were. But because many autistic people need to go three times a day, they've got some kind of reason for needing to do that or diagnosis. And so if you're disabled and for any reason you need to leave the house more than once a day, they've changed the law so you don't have to break it to do what you need to do. And so she asked me to tell you that. Also, I have a new show called The New Normal. It's a guilty feminist show, Monday to Friday, 6 p.m. UK time on Instagram Live at The Guilty Feminist. We've got some amazing guests, and old episodes are all on YouTube. I say old, they're not very old because we've only started it during lockdown, but it's all about the quarantine and how our Guilty Feminist regulars and guests are coping with it. So check out The New Normal. Also, could you please check out Grown Up Land? It is an amazing podcast, and the lockdown special especially has an amazing, amazing, amazing monologue from Steve Alley about the refugee experience and how it relates to us now, how we're being thrust into that kind of change. So please listen to it. In fact, we'll trail a little bit of that at the end of this episode so you can hear it. Go to BBC Sounds, Grown Up Land, and you want the lockdown episode, and listen to the whole thing because it's so good. There are two experts, one on viruses and one a doctor who's also Heidi Regan's fiancé. And it's brilliant. It's Sophie Duca, Heidi Regan, Ned Sedgwick, and Steve Alley. Also, I'm now on an app called Cameo. I'm raising money for Help Refugees. If you would like me to make a little video for a friend who's a Guilty Feminist fan, maybe it's their birthday, maybe you're saying thank you, congratulations, anything like that, just a pep talk. I've done a few for people who work in the NHS, just saying, hey, you go. You go on there, you find me, it's Cameo, and you find my name, and you say the video that you want, and the money that you pay goes straight to Choose Love to help refugees. All right.
Can I try something?
Yes.
You know when you did your I'm a Feminist?
Yes.
Yes.
Do you have a feminist part? Oh, I wasn't going to ask for this. Sahira, do you have an I'm a Feminist part?
I do. This actually is true. I'm a feminist, but I missed my lady who threads my upper lip.
Oh.
Because it was so long that I decided to try home waxing and took all the skin off. And it's a good thing I get to wear a mask at work because nobody could tell.
That's amazing. So here, if it makes you feel better, I've grown my body hair from the neck down so thoroughly that underneath my armpits, I got two new pets. Feel way less lonely. And then yesterday, my leg hair was so long, I was able to, I genuinely effectively used it as a towel.
I truly believe that the first Thursday after lockdown, we will come out onto the streets and we will applaud the waxers and the threaders.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
We will. Those waxers will be emergency service. They'll be working 23 hours a day, the waxers. They'll be coming to your home. The amount of hair that's going to get ripped off after lockdown, I can't even think.
There's going to be a hair mountain. Do you remember at the beginning of the EU when there was that butter mountain in Brussels? There'll be a body hair mountain, won't there?
We're going to have a landfill for it. We can't put that down drains.
They'll have to replace them. We'll have just got rid of the fatbergs in our sewers and we'll replace them with waxbergs, dense with the hair of women.
And finally, to wrap up this amazing episode, please welcome the incredible Grace Patry and Folky Ben. Grace, do you have a relevant song that you'd like to sing for us?
Okay, so. God Save the Hungry. So. There's been a lot of talk during Corona times about it being a great leveller. And a great equaliser, and it's not fucking true, is it? It's not true in any regard. And so I wrote a song a couple of years ago about the monarchy and how I'm not a monarchist personally. If you are familiar with any of my work, you will not find that very surprising. But I just think there's an awful lot of unequal shit going on in Britain and in the world. And as Jess Foster Q very eloquently said earlier on, I think that times like this bring those things into very, very sharp relief. So this is a song that I wrote about the inequality of life in Britain, particularly encapsulated by the royal family. But I think that it touches on a lot of what we're talking about today. It's called God Save the Hungry, and it goes like this. Am I an agitator? Thinking it's cool that some were born to suffer while some were born to rule. Does that make me a traitor? Before you toss that word around, please understand that I love this land of mine. And yeah, it's true, God ain't my thing, but if he was, I'd rather sing for
save those desperate souls whose lives were torn apart by war. God save the homeless and those with disability and all the other targets of this heartless ideology. And there's a long and shameful list of folks we need God to assist. For those who sleep in palaces at night, I think they're doing all right. Be greater if it had fairness at its heart. Yeah, this nation altogether is more than the sum of its parts. But they'll call you a traitor for even daring to believe a sleight of hand from those who plead this land to right. And yeah, it's true, God ain't my thing, but if he was, I'd rather sing all of the refugees perishing in up on the shores, fleeing our state-sponsored wars. Our leader speaks sound at night, cause he's got all the lyrics right. Well, and God save the hungry, and God save the poor, and God save those desperate souls whose lives were torn apart by a war. God save the homeless and those with disabilities and all the other targets of this heartless ideology. God to assist those who sleep in palaces at night. I think they're doing all right. I think they're doing all right. So give me a song, the one stick in my throat. If you agree, the only power we should respect is that come from a vote, yeah. And give me a song, the one stick in my throat. To see our millionaire politicians say we're all in the same boat. And yeah, it's true, God ain't my thing, but if he was, I'd rather sing for all of the refugees perishing in foreign seas. Those bodies washed up on the shores, we're fleeing our state-sponsored wars. And sees nothing wrong, so raise your voice and sing along, yeah. God save the hungry, God save the poor, God save those desperate souls whose lives were torn apart by war. God save the homeless and those with disabilities and all the other targets of this heartless ideology. And my gratitude to all the brave soldiers spinning in their grave, see the eaten mess that they made up, the sacrifice they gave to tear apart the welfare state and all that ever made Britain great. And those who sleep in palaces tonight, they're still doing all right.
You have been listening to The Guilty Feminist with me, Deborah Frances White, guest co-host Jessica Foster Q, and our very special guest Sarah Cornish Spencer and Zahira Hassan Ali, with music from Grace Petrie and Folky Ben. The Guilty Feminist theme tune was composed by Mark Hodge and produced by Nick Sheldon. The producer was Tom Zielinski for The Spontaneity Shop. Thanks to Rachel Croft and Gina Disco and everyone who made this episode happen, as well as all of you for listening. For more information about this and other episodes, visit guiltyfeminist.com. At the moment, I mean, what's the feeling there when we all come out and applaud on a Saturday?
Thursday, Debs.
Oh, Thursday. Sorry, I'll take that again. When we all, I've been doing it.
Debs has been out on her own on the Saturday,
just out me on my own with tin pans, going, yeah. Why is my street not enthusiastic? And what's that din on a Thursday night? When we all come out and applaud on a Thursday,
as promised, here is, as promised. Is a speech, monologue, piece.
As promised, here's a piece from Grown Up Land, and it's from Steve Alley, a Syrian refugee, talking about how the lockdown has parallels to being a refugee. It's from episode 70 of Grown Up Land on BBC Sounds, and it's called Grown Up Land in Lockdown. I cannot recommend this series highly enough. I know I produced it, but really, genuinely, the latest season, just absolutely incredible. Sophie Duker, Heidi Regan, Ned Sedgwick, and Steve Alley. And the lockdown episode is particularly brilliant. It has two experts, one on viruses and the other one a doctor. This speech really, really moved me. I would recommend you listen to all of Grown Up Land, but particularly the latest ones and the lockdown one. And so now over to Steve Alley.
When I heard people saying how only a few weeks ago, the coronavirus situation seemed very remote. Something happened far away from us to which we couldn't relate. It reminded me of how I felt when revolutions broke out in the other Arab countries, and how to me it seemed like something that could never happen in Syria. I sometimes hear things like, I think tsunamis are worse than war zones, or famine is worse than pandemics. The thing is, you can't compare one bad time to another. You cannot in any way liken this pandemic to the Blitz, because every experience is different. But there are definitely similar attributes, and I cannot speak for all, but from my personal experience. My experience with the situation is different because I am used to things changing all the time. My experiences have taught me to always be prepared to change, to keep my boots by my pillow because any given moment in time can be the time to go. Many of you are used to things being the same, or at least to being in control of change. Most of us have not experienced something like this before, and may be in the state of wondering if this is ever going to end. You go on the streets now and you've never seen or known the shops to be closed ever in your life. Cities lifeless. It is as though we are in a dystopian movie and we ask ourselves, is this ever going to end? Is it going to be normal again? Will everything go back to the way it was? When you are going through a bad time, it feels like it's never going to end. And that is the depressing part. If someone had said to me, you will have to be stuck in the Khalid jungle refugee camp for 2 years, but after that you will be safe, get what you want, and life will be good again, I would have been like, yeah, I can do 2 years, it's fine. But because we don't know if this is going to be 2 weeks or 2 months or 2 years, that is the hard part, and it is really easy to lose hope. When I first left home, I wasn't sure either how long I would be gone for. I was all on my own, and my future went from a perfect plan to an absolute limbo. That is the big challenge. It is when all the odds defy our beliefs and contest everything we know. It is uncertainty we struggle with most in life. But are we not driven by uncertainty? If we knew everything, life would be boring. We wouldn't strive for anything. Take love and death as an example. The uncertainty of love, when it will come, how long it will last, and when it will go, is what drives us to find it. The uncertainty of death hour is what propels us to live. The uncertainty in hope and despair, the anticipation of good times, the premonition of bad times, infused with our innate curiosity, is what makes us who we are. Truth is, it's never going to be normal again. Things will be different. Some businesses will not afford to reopen. Hygiene standards will be different. The way we do certain things will be different. But this period will end. And in the same way that for me, things aren't normal now, and they never went back to the way they were, new things happened, and some things are nice now. So this will end, and we don't know what will start. We don't know what the new thing is, but we will get through it. Although staying at home by choice is very different from feeling forced, you learn to adapt. That is the thing you learn as a refugee. You learn to adapt to change and accommodate difficult circumstances. While this change was not a choice you made, it was imposed on you, and you had no say in it. You learn and you adapt anyway. The process may be very different, but the outcome is similar. If you are in a life and death situation, and you are not quick to adapt, you fall behind. In such situations, events occur at such a rapid pace, an overwhelming intensity that fear for your life dominates your whole being and limits your thinking. Thinking takes time. And in such situations, a second, a footstep, can be that brittle barrier between life and death. You can only think of many people. In our current situation, we are lucky we have each other. We are physically isolated, but we have communication. We don't have to make rushed decisions. We don't have to run. We just have to wait. And as frustrating as that may be, it is a reset button. It is a gift to pause and evaluate. What are we doing? Where are we going? Am I in the right job? Am I doing the right degree? Many of us are back with our families who we have been detached from. Our families who we don't get on with. Maybe it is a time to make up. It is difficult to be with your family that you don't get on with. I had that with my parents when I was younger. But when I left, I missed them. And I wished I could have that time again with them and do things differently. Is this a time of reckoning for all of us? Or is it a time to take a break and put down those weights for a while? We just need to patiently wait for the storm to clear and for the dust to settle, then make a move and let our curiosity conquer whatever uncertainty there will be. We will adapt. We will innovate. We will make good times for ourselves. We will have fun in the bad times. We will find our connections, like we are capable of finding joy in a cold glass of red wine mixed with the smell and taste of tear gas in a cold winter night in a refugee camp. We are capable of finding joy in isolation and loneliness in uncertain time. Bad times remind us of and make us appreciate good times. There is beauty in change. There is intimacy in change. One that grows between you and the self that you grow into. Change is independence, is confidence. Change is a storm. Wear all your fragilities and dance with it. You will learn its ways and you shall harness its power. Like refugees, go to a new place and learn the language. Learn the ways of new environments and where and how they fit in. We will all learn our ways after this. We will all learn our ways after this. We will all be refugees from this pandemic. From the way we wash our hands, to the way we live our lives, the way we think of ourselves and the way we perceive others. Let us be refugees from us and others, to all of us. Let us be refugees of empathy and compassion. Things might not go back to being the same way, but we will take good things from this with us. The one thing I can tell you, this will not be forever. This too shall pass, and another thing will be.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
A huge thank you to the amazing patrons who have supported this podcast at the Smash the Patriarchy level or above. Valerie Marr, Jonquil Coy, Sarah Boom, and Sarah.